We're going to open our Rules Committee meeting today on June 15th. And hopefully we won't be having too many more of these Rules Committee meetings. That would be good. But I would like to acknowledge for the umpteenth time that we are going to hold over Senate Bill 507 and 508A, I believe, for the last time to tomorrow. I am feeling very confident that tomorrow we will be working on 507 and 508. But today we will hold it over for one more day. And with that, we're going to have... see who's here. I think we'll start with a public hearing on House Bill 3313. And so I'll open a public hearing on 3313. And I want to acknowledge that we're working with some other people, but this bill, in large part, is going to be changed. And I wanted people to get on the record to hear part of that. So I don't think it's important necessarily to read the contents of the current bill, but I would love to hear from... some people, so that we start to get an understanding of what we're doing. 3313, for those who don't know, has a relating clause that allows it to be of use to some of us in agriculture. And so we are going to hear today from a couple of people who have some amendments, and hopefully we'll be able to move forward tomorrow on this bill. So we'll have, let's have Jeff Stone, Dave Fiscombe, and Roger Beyer all come up to begin with. That way we can get three different ideas, and then we'll have some others. And so since the substance is really going to change more to what Mr. Stone has to say, we'll let him start.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. We are before you today, and you have extensive testimony that's going to be handed out from me regarding amendments to House Bill 3313 that deal primarily with the definition of what we call hoop houses. A hoop house is a temporary structure. If you think of it as PVC pipe with a tarp, that's temporary. That's a hoop house. Much of these structures were damaged significantly in the winter storms of 2008. There was a lot of press about what 18 inches of snow and ice will do to a temporary structure, particularly if they're not heated. And it did upwards towards $50 million worth of damage in structures and plant material to the nursery and greenhouse industry this last winter. We have obtained a presidential declaration of disaster, administrative declaration from the Farm Services Agency, and our members continue to rebuild. And you're going to hear, Mr. Chair, from Tom Fessler from Woodburn Nursery and Azalea that can talk a lot more about what these structures are and the reasons that we need this amendment. The Department of Revenue is undergoing rulemaking to examine the differences between a hoop house and a normal greenhouse. Think of a greenhouse as a cement slab with actual structure around it that's permanent. Hoop houses, while they may be plentiful amongst the nursery and greenhouse industry, are temporary structures. In large measure, a legislative fix is needed because there is rulemaking undergoing by Department of Revenue, and we're working with the Department of Revenue, the Attorney General's Office, to try to come up with a set of amendments that will suit this committee and this bill. We are continuing after this meeting to meet with Department of Revenue to come up with a final set of amendments. And so, Mr. Chair, I'll let my member talk about the hoop houses more completely when he comes up.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon, committee members. For the record, Dave Fiscombe. It's nice to see you again. This time I'm representing Hewlett-Packard, and particularly Hewlett-Packard's high technology plant in Corvallis. I'm here to advocate that you consider adding an amendment to House Bill 3313 dealing with an interesting issue in the arena of field burning, one I did not know about until I arrived at this legislative session. The issue, in short, is summarized in a document that's being passed out, a document that Hewlett-Packard has used all session to summarize the issue. It is essentially that through a strange set of physics circumstances. What happens when fields are burned under major power transmission lines is that short-circuiting can occur in those lines, and that causes a problem for Hewlett-Packard and, in fact, any other business or residents in the Mid-Valley area where that occurs. For Hewlett-Packard, given the character of its operation in Corvallis, the cost of each instance of what the engineers at Hewlett-Packard call a power sag is in the neighborhood of $100,000, obviously a round number, associated with both the lost time, the time, effort, and energy put into rebooting all of the microprocessing equipment, as well as the lost wafers in the production process. Six times, and I believe the letter you have indicates that six times in the last 5 or 6 years these power sags have occurred. Only one recently in 2008, as a matter of fact. And we brought this issue to the legislature in an attempt to seek some relief, and there's been some interest in doing that for Hewlett-Packard. We appreciate that. The idea would be that critical non-burn areas may be established under major power transmission lines, the lines that would carry 100,000 volts of electricity as opposed to the smaller distribution lines. The Department of Agriculture would write rules relative to that and might consider in the rules such issues as how far away from underneath a major power transmission line could burning occur, where with some proximity or some sense of the estimate that would then avoid the power outage, power sag issue. I want to emphasize that this issue applies not just to Hewlett-Packard. In all the conversations I've had on this issue, it's been described. We have described this as an issue that affects all kinds of businesses and industries and corporations and companies in the Mid-Valley area, and then as well residences when power outages would occur. Obviously, in this legislative session, we have no ability, you have no ability to stop acts of God that cause power outages, but you have some ability, I would submit to you, to consider this kind of an approach to deal with power outages that are caused by field burning. I've prepared amendments, these -7 amendments, but I should say, and my colleague to my right will emphasize this perhaps in his comments, we have worked together in the last hours, late last week and today, on language that will come back to you by tomorrow, I presume, that represents a consensus between Hewlett-Packard and the Seed Council that will be a change, Mr. Chair, to the -7s, which I know you have in your office. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about this issue, but with that, I'll stop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Seed Council. Mr. Fiskum has outlined the issue for you already, as I have testified and to in front of committees this session and talked to many of you in your offices. The Oregon Seed Council and the Oregon grass seed industry is ready, willing, and able to sit down and talk about the impacts of burning and doing anything we can to mitigate those impacts wherever possible. This issue was brought forward, and if you would want to look back to the -5 amendments, I believe it was submitted on behalf of the Oregon Seed Council for Senate Bill 528, you would see we designated a similar stat section such as this. I have been working with Mr. Fiskum in the last few days in order to come up with some language that we could agree to that would alleviate the problem of, hopefully alleviate the problem of causing power outages by field burning. I believe we are very close. There is language in legislative council being drafted, and hopefully it will be done before your committee tomorrow. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'd be happy to entertain any questions on the issue.
Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Tom Fessler, Sean Cleave, and John Phillips. That's it for this one.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Fessler from Woodburn Nursery and Azaleas. I'm just here to clarify a couple things on the hoop house issue. Back in 1994, our firm built a retractable greenhouse that replaced some hoop houses, and we felt that it should be exempt from taxation. and at the encouragement of our county assessor, Ron Ebner at the time, I mean Doug Ebner, we went ahead and filed an appeal on that, and we were successful and won a magistrate decision on that, that it was exempt. And thought we had most of the issues solved. And then in 1996, we built a different structure, greenhouse with a poly covering, but it had polycarbonate ends, and was taxed on that again, and at the encouragement of Richard Kreiser, the Marion County assessor at that time, we went and filed an appeal on that, and was successful in that appeal also. And so I just wanted to bring that up, and basically, in our opinion, the original hoop house thing has not kept up with the technology used in the nursery industry today. At the time, labor wasn't an issue. These days, labor is a big issue. And so we're doing things differently to minimize our labor, mechanize things more. And so that was our decision to build that way. The other thing is, on the other side of it, we have 85 acres of greenhouses that are heated, and we are paying tax on those right now. So we have two different divisions there. One of them is outdoor material. The other one is florist azaleas for the greenhouse market. And I'm not arguing that at all. We're paying our taxes there, and that's the way it came down 30-plus years ago. So that's kind of all I had, unless there's any questions from anyone.
We'll hear from each person, then we'll come back. But thank you.
You're welcome.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleve, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. Many of our members are also members of the OAN, and we are completely supportive of finding a legislative remedy in 3313 regarding when what is being used for a greenhouse is a temporary structure and when it is permanent. It's our belief that these hoop houses, which are PVC, very temporary, non-permanent in that they're very susceptible to weather damage, and should be exempt under Oregon's current taxation structure for ad valorem tax, and that's what this piece of legislation speaks to. I'll add that we've worked very closely with the Department of Revenue in their discovery period through their rulemaking process. And affixed through a statutory mechanism is the most eloquent way to approach this. So I'll wrap up my testimony. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. And I think the fundamental issue with the statute that you're looking at for an amendment here is that the very opening line says the following real property, machinery and equipment, or tangible personal property are exempt. And so over the years, it's been a concern about defining what is machinery and equipment and what is tangible personal property. And as Mr. Fessler mentioned, you know, the industry has evolved in its interest in building and protecting these plants. And it did start out many times as PVC pipe with some plastic. But I think what we're finding out there in the field is that there's steel frame structures that are more like, that are not more like, they're actually real property buildings and structures. And so in that sense, a real property building which is affixed to the ground and built with steel frame construction does not really fit under machinery, equipment, or personal property. So in the definitions in the appraisal world, that's just not a good fit. The first attempt to try to bring in an exemption placed another bullet under the list of machinery, equipment, and personal property, and it was just a bad fit. It does not work. And so we have, as Jeff Stone indicated, and Sean, working with everyone to try to get a definition that will add the new category, which is a real property building or structure improvement that will actually address the concerns of the Nursery Association. So we're happy to continue working with them on that.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand it, somewhere you folks are working on common language to define a hoop house in such a way that it is an exempt building, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that's what we were asked to do, and that's what we're working on.
And it's going to come back tomorrow along with HB's amendment about burning, all on this bill. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair,
and this, you don't have to answer that, all of you, just nod. I'm seeing nods. And all this is going to happen by tomorrow.
We're committed to do our part.
And I haven't seen any of this language yet, Mr. Chair.
You should have had the dash.
You had the dash
eights. And that's pretty close. That's got most of the language.
Okay, so if I studied up on the dash eights, I'd be close.
It doesn't have the feral burning, but it has the tube house.
I'd be close.
You'd be close.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know, Mr. Chair. That was just exactly what all these people are going to do by tomorrow.
And the only other part that we have is that we do have a statement that we're not sure that the legislative group believes that our relating clause might not encompass this.
Oh, well, we don't.
So we'll work on that later.
We'll work on that later.
Yeah, I'm working on that one at the same time.
That's easy.
So we're working on all those things at the same time.
Thank you. Just wanted to be clear.
But I really felt we needed to have a hearing at least so you'd start getting a chance to
ask the
questions.
So I could read the dash.
Yeah, I thought that would be helpful.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any other questions for our group here? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Go to work.
So we're going to, is there anybody else here that would like to speak to 3313? Seeing none, we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3313, and we will carry over to tomorrow a work session on 3313. And now we're going to open a public hearing on, let's go to ACR 16. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roden, members of the committee. Senate Concurrent Resolution 16 congratulates the Portland Trailblazers on the success of their 2008-2009 National Basketball Association season. The Trailblazers entered the National Basketball Association in 1970, playing their home games in the Memorial Coliseum until moving to their current home in the Rose Garden in 1995. Trailblazers have been Oregon's only major league sports team since joining the NBA. They will be joined by the Portland Timbers in 2010 when that team enters Major League Soccer. The franchise held a contest to select the team name in 1970. The most popular choice, Pioneers, was already used by Lewis and Clark College, however, so Trailblazers was selected as the second most popular choice. Since its inaugural season, the Trailblazers franchise has enjoyed a strong following. The team holds the record for most consecutive sellouts in American professional sports, selling out 814 consecutive games between 1977 and 1995. The team's qualified for the NBA playoffs 26 times in its 38 NBA seasons. The team missed the playoffs during its first six seasons, after which it advanced the playoffs in 25 of the next 26 years before missing the playoffs for five consecutive years from 2004 to 2008. The Trailblazers advanced to the NBA Finals three times, winning the championship in 1977. Senate Concurrent Resolution 16 congratulates the Portland Trailblazers for a successful 2008-2009 season, in which the team returned to the playoffs following a five-year absence. The current roster ranks as the second youngest in the league, led by All-Star Brandon Roy, who was named the All-NBA second team at the end of the regular season. That's it.
Okay. So this was originally Senator Carter's.
It was Senator Carter's bill, and she's not able
to be here today. So discussion. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to it? I didn't get anybody on my pamphlet. Representative Berger.
Yeah, well, where's Brandon Roy?
I know.
I kind of thought he'd be here for this, and I don't see him.
Is he the same Brandon Roy that graduated from Crescent Valley High School, or is this a different one?
No, it's the one that graduated from the University of Washington.
University.
So he did not go to high school in Corvallis, is what you're telling me.
No, I don't think so.
Representative Girard.
Mr. Chair, it is just a comment. I was a young sportscaster in 1970. When in Klamath Falls, I got visited by an equally young man at that time, Bill Shonley, and he had some kid by the name of Jeff Petrie with him. And they were trying to develop the Trailblazer radio network. And to this day, those are gold moments still in my mind. So I'm happy to support this bill.
And
Any other discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd like to comment that during the playoffs, I am and was conflicted because as much as I love the Blazers, Rick Adelman's a good friend. He never should have left Portland. And if they're going to be beat by somebody, that's the team to beat them. But they'll be back next year.
And my comment is that the Blazers have, over the years, gone out to other small communities and had games with other professional teams. And at Coos Bay, we've hosted them. My son was one of the ball boys when they came to Coos Bay. And really wonderful experiences for all of the state to have those opportunities. And I really appreciate the Blazers doing that and making that a part of what they are. And I want to commend this current group of Blazers. I was disappointed as a high school principal for a few years because the behaviors were not easy to explain to kids. This current crop has changed all of that and is truly a positive experience for our state, and I appreciate what they have done. So, Representative Gelser.
Mr. Chair, I'm thinking back to Hearing Room 50 many weeks ago when we were learning about gravel removal and fill, and I think I knew more about that than I do about the Trailblazers. However, I noticed on my Facebook status updates that many of my colleagues in this building seem to be watching games involving Trailblazers, so I'll trust my colleagues that this is an appropriate and right thing to do, and sometime maybe I'll get to watch a game.
So is there anyone else that would like to speak to this resolution? If not, we're going to close our public hearing on SCR 16. We're going to open a work session on SCR 16. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move SCR 16 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Representative Berger moves SCR 16 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Garrard.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Nolan.
Excused.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Excused.
And Chair Roland.
Aye. Motion passes, and I am going to have, since one of the star players happens to be a University of Washington graduate, we'll let Representative Reed carry this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
I didn't know that about him, Mr. Chair. Gee, that does change my opinion.
Too late.
The gavel's down. So we're going to close our work session on SCR 16, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 119. And with that, we'll get a short explanation, and if you both want to come up, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 119 allows the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to discipline a person who is licensed by or registered with the commission if the person resigned from a public school without providing appropriate notice. It declares an emergency effective July 1, 2009. There is a -1 amendment which would allow the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to issue a letter of reproval to a licensed, registered, or certified person under specified circumstances. Requires the letter to establish terms of a monitoring period for a person to whom it is issued. Permits the Commission to notify the employer to whom the letter or reproval has been issued. Establishes that the letter of reproval is confidential and, except when disciplinary action is taken, may not be posted on an interstate clearinghouse related educator license. Sanctions. Permits the Commission to take disciplinary action if a person fails to comply with the terms of a letter of informal reproval, and repeals provisions related to those letters of reproval on July 12, 2012. Requires the Commission to submit a report regarding the effectiveness of letters of approval to the Interim Legislative Committee related to education no later than October 1, 2012. In terms of background, the current statutes require the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to suspend the license of an educator who has entered into a teaching contract and resigns without 60-day notice to the school district. The Commission reports that by the time the case can be considered, the educator is often employed in another district. Suspension of the educator may be a hardship on the newly employing school district and that district's students. SB 119 addresses this issue by allowing the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to discipline the educator and requires the Commission to follow statutory guidelines for disciplining teachers and other school personnel. The measure also clarifies an administrative law judge conducts administrative hearings or disciplinary hearings.
So with that, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I think we were here before your committee. No, we've never been before your committee on this. We were in front of the Senate Education Committee and the House Education Committee, so that my notes never tell a lie, except when I get it wrong. And I appreciate Representative Gelser moving us over to rules, because there, I don't think there was sufficient time for the committee members to really understand what we were trying to do. So that gave us more time to develop this concept with folks. Ms. Chamberlain's going to speak to the underlying bill, which is her agency bill, Senate Bill 119. And then I had the amendment, and this was something Ms. Chamberlain and I worked on for months, actually, almost a year now, a year ago now, after the last session. I went over to visit with her at her office about some things with regard to education policy, and I tossed this one out, this idea, and so we began developing it. The bill that came out, however, to be drafted, that was drafted, was not a good bill. Our first stab at it actually took about five drafts before we got what we needed, and by then it was past the bill introduction deadline. So, I introduced one bill, actually, quite late, Senate Bill 333, and my committee on the Senate had not had time to look at it. So we have decided to try to move it here. What we're trying to do with the amendment is just simply set up an monitoring program, as Mr. Watson indicated. And this is for situations where teachers do things that really don't rise to the level of getting a discipline in terms of having something in their record. But let's try to give them an opportunity to try to be a better educator. And let me give you some examples that Ms. Chamberlain has pointed out. First-time viewing of inappropriate websites, statewide testing cases where it appears the educator helped the student. Now, that's not really a good thing for a teacher to be helping the student take the test, and maybe they didn't realize to what extent they were helping them. So a letter of informal reproval is simply, we don't want you to do this again. We need you to take some extra training to learn how to appropriately assist a student to take a test. If you meet this training and you come back and show us within a period of time that you've done well, then this won't go on your permanent licensure. Other things are repeated incidents with alcohol. I know when I was talking with Ms. Chamberlain once, there was an educator who was getting a divorce from a spouse, a very, very messy divorce where the spouse had sort of had a relationship with someone else during the marriage, and this educator got very upset, began drinking, and that drinking impacted her in the classroom. And so these are the kinds of things where we can put someone in a treatment program and say, you know, get yourself cleaned up. We're here to help you because we know you're a good educator. And then they come back and have proven themselves, and then they do not get sanctioned into their record. I think that's a humane thing to do, because we've actually been holding educators pretty accountable this session on a lot of things. And we have been very strict about that, and I think there are some little missteps that educators make along the way that we could resolve with this informal method of discipline. Also, there's another example, a long record of exemplary service followed by unexplained anger or other inappropriate conduct. I can think of my son, for one. What if my son, who is a first-year teacher, gets really mad at a student and actually swears at them or something like that inappropriate? Well, that's a pretty significant sanction for a first-year teacher. And so maybe a letter of informal approval would be better, where they can get some additional training. So this is actually a pilot program that we think would be a good thing to do. And I suppose since my son is a teacher, I should probably list that I have a potential conflict of interest, but legislative counsel tells me I do not, because he's part of a larger class. But I think this is a good idea. I think it's a good experiment. Ms. Chamberlain has wanted to do something like this for a very long time in their agency, and I think she can make this work. I think the educators, the alphabet soup folks who always testify are not opposed to this. They had some concerns on the Senate side because the letter of informal reproval was not confidential. And we thought it that maybe we should have it open because everyone wants open records, but it was their thought that if you're trying to help someone overcome a difficulty, let's have that confidential until this thing is resolved and dismissed. So that was where we went with that. Did I misrepresent that in any way, Ms. Chamberlain? Okay. So I think this just gives them some additional tools instead of the black or white that they're left with right now.
Any questions for our senator? So if she needs to leave, she can. I think we're okay.
Actually, if I stay here, no one can bother me.
And that's a good thing.
Chair Robelum.
Yes. Representative Jensen.
That was a rather presumptuous senator, wasn't it?
Unfortunately, on my cell phone, and my staff texts me wherever I am. But
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, the Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. One slight little change to what Senator Walker told you. These would be cases where there's evidence of misconduct, that it's not severe or serious misconduct. And I think it's the commission kind of refers to them as the grit your teeth cases. There's circumstances where there is evidence of misconduct. It's serious enough that the commission doesn't feel like they can just dismiss it. But it's also heartbreaking to put a public discipline on a 30-year teacher or a brand new teacher who's had some moment of lapse. And the cases come up myriad. The statewide testing cases are very interesting because they boil down to intent to help the student or misunderstanding of what was allowed in terms of what they can do in terms of administering the test. And so those actually end up being some interesting gray areas. And then there gets to be, okay, you're 32 years old, you should have known better. So, but the whole point here is there's actually it's difficult to explain, but situations where you know that if you gave this person an opportunity to perhaps get anger management training or some more classroom management training or something like that, have a clean record for 2 years, and then it comes back to the commission and gets dismissed because it came in the door as a complaint. If in the meantime, during the monitoring period, and this has to be agreed upon by the educator the way the bill's written, so nobody would be forced into this unless they wanted to do it. In the meantime, if let's say they had another incident that was related or similar or any other incident, it takes the reproval off the table, reopens the case, goes back in front of the commission, and then they would decide whether they're going to charge the educator with misconduct. So it's the sunset is June 30, 2012, and we would expect to come back to the next session and tell you how it's working. It would be analogous to diversion in minor crime situations where it's not just a warm the seat. There's usually something that the folks would be doing. Those are the amendments. The underlying bill is important because this is a statute that is many decades old, and the only solution the commission has of the way the statute is written is that if the school district reports an educator for quitting without giving the district 60 days notice, the commission is directed to suspend their license for the remainder of the year. By the time we get through due process, everyone is entitled to it. They have a right to a hearing. It's really hard to get these cases settled inside of that school year. And that's the only thing the statute says we can do is suspend their license. Well, like the testing cases, there are a million situations. And the statute isn't clear that the commission cannot take action. But what has happened typically in the last half dozen cases or more that the commission has considered is that these folks have left their job to go to other jobs. They've established themselves in classrooms in other school districts. They've been in there for months. We're looking at 10 weeks before the end of the school year, and we're going to suspend their license. So now you impose a hardship on the other district. The commission would like an option to do something else, like the person who called in Sunday night at midnight and didn't show up on Monday, and then we got clear to the end of the school year before that case could be decided because of the appeals. The commission couldn't take action because the school year was up. So they're just messy cases. So as long as the commission has to deal with them, the commission's asking for the opportunity to do something differently. Like, that was egregious. You really put a hardship on that district, and you should be suspended for 30 days whenever we get to it, or you should be reprimanded, or this case should be dismissed. It would just be cleaner. So those are the two big ideas in this legislation.
Representative Berger.
Thank you for that explanation, and these seem reasonable. On the dash one amendment, it says sub 2, section 5, the letter of informal approval issued is provided by the subsection, quote, shall establish the terms of monitoring period. Do you, Vicki, intend to make that fit the crime? Is that period of, what do you envision in there for that period of monitoring?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, it would be very similar to what we do right now with probations. Right now, the commission can do probation from 0 to 4 years. And so it would be except that a probation is considered a discipline, and that goes on to the national index. So it would be exactly that. Let's take the alcohol cases. Nobody wants to talk about them, but they're actually the easiest ones. If the person, this actually was a case, had 28 years of service, had no blemish on her personnel record, and showed up 2 times under the influence at work. One was at a parent-teacher conference. It was heartbreaking. So how this would work in that situation is the commission, if she agreed, would enter a letter of reproval, ask her to get an alcohol evaluation, and if the evaluation required a period of treatment, would extend the monitoring period over the period of treatment, and then review it at the end and take it from there. And actually, that's a great example because people who actually want to adhere to their treatment and are committed to their treatment do. And at the end of the period, it becomes an easy decision, bless you. And the folks who don't have a tendency to, usually a condition would be like probation is no drinking, would be in the letter, and then they may have a DUII, or actually, interestingly, their colleagues report on them because they tell on themselves. So, but anyway, those are the easy cases. That would be how it would work. So let's just say somebody was unable to refrain from drinking, if that was the term of the period, bring it back, take it to the commission, and say, here was the initial case with the report. You were going to charge them. You negotiated a monitoring. The terms of the monitoring were no drinking. That person chose to drink. Now we're back before you. We're going to charge and take it through the discipline route, wherever that ends up. That's how I see it working.
Other questions or comments? I guess what I would say is I really do appreciate the underlying bill as well, having been an administrator in which people have let us know the day before or the weekend before school starts that they weren't coming back, knowing that they got another job, and you know your superintendent calls both and says, why would you possibly, upset, and knowing that if you report it, probably nothing's going to happen. There's going to be this, they're going to take the job and they're going to do their work, and eventually we're going to get through the system, and at the end of the system, if there's any school left, they might get suspended for a few days, but it isn't going to do anything. To know that at the end of this process there would be a sanction, I think would give them more pause in making those last-minute decisions, which are very frustrating. And they come in a variety of reasons. Another person really wanted the job, moved, came down, and wife just couldn't stand living in the coast and ended up and left with the kids.
That's
and
me.
He was saying, I need this job, and everybody said, well, okay, you know, and he was a great teacher. I hope he did well. But I mean, depending on the situations, I think there are reasons that school districts make decisions about whether they report it or not. But I trust that the commission will make those kind of decisions and look at the facts in the case, and this gives them a variety of opportunities to deal with that one. I think that's true with the pilot project. I appreciate the fact that you chose to make it a pilot project. That we'll see how it works, and if in a couple of years we like the results, we get the information back, it seems to be working, it's a great thing to start, and then maybe it's something we continue forever because it really works and it helps people
stay on that straight and narrow. So I appreciate the work on both of these.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I might, and I appreciate your comments, because it can range all the way from first-year teachers to the long-term teachers, 28 years, because first-year teachers, we don't have enough money to put into mentoring these new teachers. And then the older ones that have been there for a while might get a little irritated with having worked in a classroom with so many children and not enough supplies that they need or whatever. What happens in their life, you know, just something small. And I will tell you, my husband's employer actually provides the opportunity for its employees to get counseling for all kinds of issues that may impact their work, and it will not impact their employment as long as they take part in the counseling and do what they need. So it's kind of a neat idea. I'm really excited about it. I'm excited that Ms. Chamberlain thinks this is going to work, and I think it's going to work. And if it doesn't, well, we can get rid of it. But I think there's a lot of potential here for flexibility and to help keep good teachers in the system who might just go astray a little bit and just need a little self-correction with a little help.
Any further questions? I do want to commend both of you for your persistence. We wouldn't be sitting here today if it weren't for the two Vickies that are sitting out there, probably, so I appreciate that as well.
Well, you know, the three Vickies in this room are very persistent people.
So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And is there anybody else that wants to testify to Senate Bill 119? Seeing no one else, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 119, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 119. I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Berger.
I move the dash one amendment be adopted into Senate Bill 119.
Representative Berger moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 119. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
We heard this bill in the House Ed Committee. It came late, and so we didn't have enough time to work through it, but I do think it's a very good bill. It's a nice complement to the other work that we have done this session in terms of holding people accountable. Part of holding people accountable is giving tools to recover, and I really commend the two Vickies for the work that they've done to bring this forward and look forward to seeing it on the floor.
Any other discussion? Seeing that, is there any disagreement with the amendment? Seeing none, so order. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 119 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 119 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the major motion?
Okay, question.
Representative?
What is the difference between due pass and be adopted?
Resolution or a bill?
Okay.
Resolutions we adopt and do pass, so those bills will become part of our statutes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, any other discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote. I like doing that.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
I don't know.
It counts as a yes if you don't vote.
Don't tempt me.
No, I wasn't going to. That was your other Republican.
Yeah, friend. No, I know.
That's it, Mr. Chair. Just pass it on down here.
I reserve the right to try to kill it on the floor, but I'll vote yes here.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Excused.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes. Did you want to carry this, Representative Jensen?
Sure.
Representative Roblin?
Yes.
I know that Representative Jensen has made a very compelling case for carrying the bill on the floor, but if he does not wish to, I would be happy to.
We will have Representative Gelser carry this bill.
He gets me out of it every time. It always works.
Because your bucket's got a hole in it.
We're going to close our hearing on Senate Bill 119. And I think that takes care of our business for the day. So, again, thank all of you. We will meet tomorrow. There's a couple bills. And Wednesday, I'm hoping Thursday will take off and Friday will take off because we won't have any business. But we'll see how that goes. Yeah. But for right now, we are scheduled for tomorrow. So with that, we're going to close our rules.
I'll go ahead.
Okay, I'll close our rules meeting for today. Thank you.
Are the amendments...